Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, chapter 14, text number 3. And it's prose, so it's not written up on the board. So I'll just read the translation and the purport. But before I do that, today is the disappearance day of Srila Jayadeva Goswami. So I'd just like to say a few things about his life. So Jayadeva Goswami was a great devotee who lived about 300 years before Lord Chaitanya, in other words, the 12th century. And he was, initially, he was residing in Bengal, and actually an area close to the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya, close to Navadvip. He was, in his adult life, he was a grihastha. His wife's name was Padmavati, and she was an expert dancer. And he and his wife lived as, they were patronized by the king of Bengal, who at the time, his name was Sri Lakshman Sen. So they were living within the court, basically, or, you know, the kingdom of Lakshman Sen, and they were looked after by him. And later on, though, he preferred to, he left the royal opulent life, and he took residence in a place called Champahati, which is very close to Navadvip. And that's where he wrote his most famous work, which was called Gita Govinda. And Gita Govinda is famous worldwide. Prabhupada describes it as a work where that describes Krishna playing on his flute about Radharani. That's a statement Prabhupada made about it in a lecture he gave. And in the book called Gaudiya Vaishnava Samadhis in Vrindavan by Mahanidhi Swami, he describes that book as expressing Radharani's intense feelings of separation for Krishna before the Rasa dance, and that book also describes the most intimate pastimes of Radha and Krishna. And Lord Chaitanya used to relish hearing Gita Govinda, particularly in the last stages of his life, last 12 years of his life, when he was living in seclusion in the Gambira, which was the maternal, it was the home of who? Somebody help me out. Gambira was Kasimishra. So he would hear verses quoted from the Gita Govinda by his confidential associates, Srup Damana, Ramananda Roy, and I believe Mukunda Dutt. Correct? Let's see. There's a very interesting pastime in connection with that work, the writing of that work, Gita Govinda. And it goes like this, that while he was in the process of writing it, at one point, he came to a point where he was thinking he wanted to write a particular, to express a particular idea. And the idea went something like this, that Krishna bows down to touch the lotus feet of Srimati Radharani. And in I guess it's Sanskrit. I think it was written in Sanskrit. It goes, Dehi Pada Palavam Udaram. So he was contemplating in his mind. I mean, he had the phrase all worked out in his mind and everything. He was going to write it down. But then he thought, I don't know, this is a bit confidential. And also, actually, no, his misgiving was that if I express that like that, does that sort of like diminish the position of Krishna? He didn't want to express anything which made Krishna look, less. So he was hesitant, and he wasn't sure. So it was around the middle of the day, so he thought, okay, before I write this down, because back in those days, I guess you were writing with on the parchment with the quill pens. I don't know exactly, but it wasn't with a pencil and an eraser. So, before he wrote it down, and which would make it difficult for him to get rid of it, maybe, he decided, okay, let me just do my noon duties. You know, I'll take bath, and I'll come back and take prashadam. And then when I sit down again to write, then, I'll, you know, by this time I'll have a chance to think about it a little bit, and then I'll decide. I'll decide during this process, you know. So he did that. He went off to take his bath. And like that, meantime, it's described that Krishna was, he was such an intimate and confidential devotee that Krishna was aware of what was going on. Krishna took the form of Jayadeva Goswami. He came, he sat down, and he wrote that line on his work. You know, he sat down right where he was working. He wrote that line down, that Dehi Pada Palavam Udaram. And then he got up, he took prashadam from his wife. His wife was preparing prashadam. His wife didn't know the difference. His wife thought that was him, Jayadeva Goswami, her husband. And then off he went. And then shortly after, Jayadeva Goswami himself returned. And he looked over at his work, and he saw that the line was there, and he knew. You know, he wasn't poor short-term memory. He wasn't. He knew it. I didn't write that. You know, I left for the purpose of having the opportunity to think about this before I wrote it down. There it is, written down. And then he went, and his wife was very surprised to see him. She said, "Well, you know, he came in for prashadam," and his wife was, "You were just here. I just served you, prashadam." And then, he understood everything. And then he was like in ecstasy because he understood that Krishna had appeared and Krishna had done this. Krishna had taken, disguised himself as him and came and wrote that line down and like that. So they were both very much excited about that. And this is just to give you an idea of the caliber of devotee that Jayadeva Goswami was, that his writing was so special that even Krishna participated in the writing of that work, Gita Govinda. He spent his last days... I'll say this first. He spent his last days in Jagannath Puri, the final part of his life, where he introduced a daily reading of the Gita Govinda in the temple. And he himself had this to say about the work, Gita Govinda. He said, "Whatever is delightful in varieties of music, whatever is graceful in fine strains of poetry, whatever is exquisite in the sweet art of love, let the happy and wise learn from the songs of Jayadeva." So that was his statement about that work. He's also the author of a very famous song that we sing. A lot of us sing Das Avatar Stotra. Actually, we sing one stanza of that song every morning at Mangalarti. Tavakata Kamalavarena Kamabhuta Sringam. That one, about Lord Nisringadev. That appears in that Das Avatar Stotra. I don't know if that's his composition or if that was something that was existed previous to his song and he just incorporated it as part of his song. That I don't know, but just so you know where that comes from. It's found in that song, Das Avatar Stotra. Okay, so that's everything about Jayadeva Goswami. Anybody have anything more about Jayadeva Goswami that they'd like to add at this point that I kind of, some important thing that I missed out, skip? No? Okay. So we'll move on to the class here. So this is, once again, chapter 5, text 14. Canto 5, chapter 14, text 2. And the chapter's title is The Forest of Enjoyment. So this is Prabhupada's translation. It says, "In the forest of material existence, the uncontrolled senses are like plunderers. The conditioned soul may earn some money for the advancement of Krishna consciousness, but unfortunately the uncontrolled senses plunder his money through sense gratification. The senses are plunderers because they make one spend his money unnecessarily for seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, desiring, and willing. In this way, the conditioned soul is obliged to gratify his senses, and thus all his money is spent. This money is actually acquired for the execution of religious principles, but it is taken away by the plundering senses." And this is Srila Prabhupada's purport. "Purva janmarjita vidya, purva janmarjitam dhanam, agre davati davati. By following the principles of Varnashram Dharma, one attains a better position in the material world. One may be rich, learned, beautiful, or high-born. One who has all of these assets should know that they are all meant for the advancement of Krishna consciousness. Unfortunately, when a person is misguided, he misuses his high position for sense gratification. Therefore, the uncontrolled senses are considered plunderers. The good position one attains by executing religious principles is wasted as the plundering senses take it away. By executing religious principles under the laws of Vanashram Dharma, one is placed in a comfortable position. One may very easily use his assets for the further advancement of Krishna consciousness. One should understand that the wealth and opportunity one gets in the material world should not be squandered in sense gratification. They are meant for advancement of Krishna consciousness. This Krishna consciousness movement is therefore teaching people to control the mind and five knowledge-acquiring senses by a definite process. One should practice a little austerity and not spend money on anything other than the regulative life of devotional service. The senses demand that one see beautiful things. Therefore, money should be spent for decorating the deity in the temple. Similarly, the tongue has to taste good food, which should be bought and offered to the deity. The nose can be utilized in smelling the flowers offered to the deity. And hearing can be utilized by listening to the vibration of the Hare Krishna mantra. In this way, the senses can be regulated and utilized to advance Krishna consciousness. Thus, a good position might not be spoiled by material sense gratification in the form of illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, and gambling. One spoils an opulent position in the material world by driving cars, spending time in nightclubs, or taking abominable food in restaurants. In these ways, the plundering senses take away all the assets that the conditioned soul has acquired with great difficulty. Om Agnati Mananda Shajananjana Shalakaya Chakshuramalatandiana Tasmai Shri Gurudeva Maha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunachananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare. So it's said in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 5, Nahi kaschit shanam api jatu tishtati akarma krit karyate hi avasha karma sarva pakriti jaganai, that all men are forced to act helplessly according to the impulses born of the three modes of material nature. No one can refrain from doing something, not even for a moment. So that verse kind of touches upon what Prabhupada's talking about here, that I'll just read a couple sentences here from the from Prabhupada's purport. He says, the body is only a dead vehicle to be worked by the spirit soul, which is always active and cannot stop even for a moment. As such, the spirit soul has to be engaged in the good work of Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, it will be engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy. That's the gist of it right there. That sentence right there. That's the principle, you know. The spirit soul has to be engaged in the good work of Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, it will be engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy. So the soul is always active. So if it's not engaged in the good work of Krishna consciousness, then it's going to be engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy. It's one or the other. There's no, like, you know, neutral zone. You know? There's no, like, island of inactivity. It's one thing or the other. And the problem is that we're already, sort of absorbed in the illusory energy. Prabhupada says here, in contact with material energy, the spirit soul acquires material modes. That's already happened. You see? And to purify the soul from such affinities, it is necessary to engage in the prescribed duties enjoined in the shastras. So a very nice analogy to help understand this, the position of the conditioned soul in the material world is that of a person trying to swim upstream. How many devotees here have been to Mayapur? Raise hands. Okay. How many devotees here have tried to swim up the Ganges when they went to Mayapur? How'd you do? You don't do it. It's very difficult. In other words, when you're trying to swim upstream, probably at least one thing that everybody's experienced is when you're trying to swim upstream, you might, depending upon how strong the current is on that particular day, you might move up a little bit. You might just be able to hold your position, or maybe not even. But certainly one thing we've all experienced is as soon as you stop swimming, as hard as you can, upstream, you're immediately carried downstream. It's not like you have to make a decision. Oh, now I don't want to go upstream anymore. I'll go downstream. You don't have to make that decision. All you have to do is just stop swimming. You know, just stop your effort to go upstream, and immediately you're just carried away downstream. And depending upon how strong the current is that day, that's what will determine how fast and how far downstream you're carried. You see? You know, you're carried away by the waves of, you know, the Ganges, or, and in the case of the conditioned soul, when he makes that decision not to be engaged in devotional service, then he's just carried away by the waves of Maya. Actually, I'll just cite one more reference here to kind of really drive this point home. This is a verse from the 13th chapter. This one I'll have to read. Yeah, this is text 30. It says, one who can see that all activities are performed by the body, which is created of material nature, and sees that the self does nothing, actually sees. And Prabhupada explains in his purport, he says, this body is made of by material nature under the direction of the supersoul. And here it comes. And whatever activities are going on in respect to one's body are not his doing. Whatever one is supposed to do, either for happiness or for distress, one is forced to do because of bodily constitution. Very clear, I think, at least to me, very clear. So, once again, back to that point that, you know, if we don't have that determination that I'm going to be engaged in devotional service, then automatically you're going to act for sense gratification because we're in a body that's designed for that purpose. You know, it's been designed, manufactured by the Supersoul and his assistants, you know, for that exact purpose. So if we don't use it for Krishna's service, we're going to use it in Maya's service. And, you know, that brings to mind the famous verse of the 7th chapter, Daiva hiyeshu gunamai mama maya dadachaya mameviya papanjate mayami tam tarantite, that Krishna says this divine energy of mine consisting of the three modes of material nature is insurmountable. It's insurmountable. But one who surrenders unto me can easily cross beyond it. So, of course, the converse is true, too. If you don't surrender to Krishna, you can't cross beyond it. Because you can't expect, we should not expect, to not be engaged in devotional service and not be influenced by Maya. That's not how it works. If we're not determined to be engaged in devotional service, we are going to be, as stated right in the beginning, engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy, like it or not, and we won't like it. And which brings me to the point, like I was saying, how, you know, the conditioned soul, there's one song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur where he talks about Mitya Maya Boshe Kapche Hubaduba. I can't remember the Bengali well enough, but he's making the point that how the conditioned soul is carried away by the waves, you know, of the illusory energy. And the reason I quoted that particular phrase is because I just want to point out that the waves now in the Kali Yuga, they're not so nice. You know, these aren't like mode of goodness type of waves. In other words, maybe in the in a previous yuga or even earlier in the Kali Yuga, when people were engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy, maybe in a previous age they might have thought, oh yeah, let me give some cows away in charity, or let me feed some Brahmins, or let me go dig some wells, or let me go plant some nice fruit shade trees. You see, that was their Maya, but it's not like that now. You know, we don't have bodies that are being dictated by those modes. You know, Prabhupada points out in his purport here what will happen if we don't engage, in devotional service. He said we're going to wind up using that, the wealth of the body, the money, whatever money we have, and just the body itself. You know, just having a human body, a healthy, human body that with the energy and the intention to be able to engage in devotional service. That's wealth, and that's a wealth in itself. That's a great wealth. So anyway, but if we're not desiring and determined to engage that in devotional service, and as Prabhupada points out here in his purport, we will be forced to engage in these sinful activities, illicit sex, meat-eating, intoxication, and gambling. And he gets more specific. He gets more specific in the next sentence, and then he says, thus, one spoils an opulent position in the material world, and this is specific, by driving cars, spending time in nightclubs, or tasting abominable food in restaurants. Specifically, those are ways in which we can, spoil this, the opportunity of the human form of life. And these things are actually, they, you know, at least driving cars might seem, of those three, you think, well, that doesn't sound so bad. What's so bad about driving cars? But actually, it's a very insidious kind of like an activity if you stop and think about it. Just like Prabhupada, on one lecture he gave here in Los Angeles, I think it was back about 1970, he was talking, he quoted the phrase, one should not live to eat, one should eat to live. And making the point that the real thing, the real purpose of eating is to maintain the body, you know, to nourish the body so you can do what you have to do, not that we should be living for that enjoyment of eating. So in the same way, I'll just to paraphrase that particular quote, one should not live to drive, but one should drive to live. See, but what we actually see here, especially in countries like in the Western countries, like, you know, United States, Canada, England, Australia, New Zealand, those are the ones I personally lived in. I think to a significant extent, people, without even realizing it, without even being aware of it, because that's how it's subtle. It's insane. They're living to drive. And driving is a great pleasure. You know, people have like, you know, if you're not interested in Krishna consciousness, if you're not interested in devotional service and pleasing Krishna, what are you interested in? You're interested in material sense gratification. So people have, you know, over human beings for now like 100 years, or, you know, let's call it hundreds of years, have been trying always to make life more comfortable, more secure. And this is what we have now here in the United States is the product of, you know, let's say at least dozens, hundreds of years of millions of people working to try to make life more comfortable and more enjoyable. And so what we have is roads that are smooth as silk. That was Prabhupada's phrase from, some lectures he gave. The road, when he was in India, he was describing to the people that he was preaching to about what it was like in America. He said, the roads are smooth as silk. You know, and then you're driving in a car at 70 miles an hour, and you don't even feel like you're, you know, it's like you're just zipping along like that. So it's a form of sense gratification. So anyway, so not to belabor the point, but if you're not careful, you know, you see so many people, they're just living to drive. They don't even realize it, but they're just, it's such a sense gratification that they just waste all their time just driving around. That's why the car industry is so successful. Because it's so enjoyable to drive a nice car. You know, the cars are nice, the roads are nice, and that's there. So that's just on that point. And then Prabhupada mentions here about spending time in nightclubs and tasting in abominable foods in restaurants. Now, we should keep in mind that this purport was written in about 1975, right? And but things have even degenerated beyond that. These days, somebody's lucky. I think people are lucky if they can get it together to take their, you know, to hop in their car and drive to a nightclub and, go to a restaurant and eat abominable food. Mostly what happens these days is people just have their car parked in the driveway and they're just making the payments on it. And they wind up sitting behind a computer looking at pornography and ringing Pizza Hut to bring in a sausage and pepperoni pizza. That's like, you know, it's like degenerated from the mode of passion to the mode of ignorance. And so that's how a lot of people are spending their time these days, you know. But the same end result is there. They're engaged in sinful activity. So what is the remedy for this? You know, the remedy is, as Prabhupada nicely points out, you know, specifies and outlines in his purport here, is engaging in devotional service, but specifically in this purport, he seems to be emphasizing deity worship. You know, at different places, Prabhupada emphasized different things, and at least in this purport, he's emphasizing the importance of deity worship. And, of course, that is true. You know, deity worship is important for the people who, you know, the outsiders, people who aren't already devotees, because it's a way they can have that initial contact with Krishna. It's easier. It's easier for, like, I mean, you don't expect somebody who's coming, first finding out about Krishna consciousness, to come along, take up a book bag and go out and start distributing books, although that is happening. Now, these days, it's happening in San Jose, and that was Sura's beginning in Krishna consciousness. But for most people, you come along and you see the deities, you take prasadam, you see how the deities are nicely dressed, you smell the flowers that have been offered to Krishna like that. The beginning is, for most people, is deity worship. So it's important for people who aren't already, in Krishna conscious or devotees of Krishna, but that's their first contact. But it's actually also important for us, too. You know, Prabhupada was writing this purport, of course, for, you know, a general audience, you know, something that we, his followers, could use to help to formulate our vision for our preaching, but also as instruction to us for our own personal lives as well. Notice, we also have to take the deity worship very seriously. Deity worship is important for those of us who are practicing sadhana bhakti. There's a very, I found an interesting quote on the Veda base. It was in the one of those, I don't know what to call it, a compilation that Rabindranath just finished reading to us about a week or so ago in the Prashanam. It's called Varnashram Dharm. So this was a quote from Bhaktivinod Thakur. It goes, at the time of practicing sadhana bhakti, so long as there is material desire within the heart, one should remain within the confines of the Varnashram system. So I'm taking the principle here, not so much specifically what he's saying. The point being that, you know, while we're still experiencing material desires, you know, we shouldn't think ourselves, you know, he's making the point, if somebody's still experiencing material desires within the heart, then they shouldn't think that, oh, I don't need the Varnashram. So in the same way, an analogy is best how I want to use this in that way, that in the same way, if we're not, if we're on that platform, you know, where we're still experiencing material desires while engaging in sadhana bhakti, then we should understand that we need to still be following the basic program that Prabhupada gave us, you know, and which included deity worship. On a walk here in Los Angeles, Prabhupada was in 1975 here in Los Angeles. Prabhupada was walking with some disciples down at Venice Beach, actually. And just right in the middle, out of the clear blue sky, Jayadvaita, then Brahmachari, made the comment, Srila Prabhupada, devotees have remarked that since you have come to L.A., the deity has increased in beauty many times. So he just said that to Prabhupada, threw that out there. They were talking about something else. And then Prabhupada said, my anxiety is that in my absence, you may neglect deity worship. Then the whole thing will be spoiled. That is my anxiety. You see, so that was Prabhupada's response at that time. So the deity worship is important. And actually on a couple other occasions, to put it in a positive way, Prabhupada described it like this. I didn't make a note of what the date here or the place, but Prabhupada said, so we should come and sing and dance in front of the deities and please them. And by their grace, we will get all success. We are not successful by our own strength. We are successful by Krishna's grace. Now, that's really important to remember. I'm going to read that one again because we're trying to be successful in devotional service. Prabhupada is telling us here point blank, you know, what is the formula, okay? He's given us a detail and the principle in one little statement here. He says, so we should come and sing and dance in front of the deities and please them. And by their grace, we will get all success. Okay? So that's the activity, and he states the principle here. We are not successful by our own strength. We are successful by Krishna's grace. And here's something that Prabhupada said in Delhi, I think it was 73. I'm sorry, I neglected to make a note of it. But this is a little bit more specific. It's on the same point. He says, he's talking to some devotees. They were, what was happening in Delhi, devotees were going out on Sankirtan early in the morning, and they were coming back late in the evening. You know, they were out all day trying to make members and like that. So, and the program was suffering, and the temple activities were kind of like suffering a bit as a result. So Prabhupada's response was, when this was brought to his attention, he said, this was not my idea that they should go to the city and collect all day and night. Our process is to please Krishna. They may go at 9 in the morning and return by 5 in the evening and then chant in front of the deities. Otherwise, they will become like karmis. So that was what Prabhupada said on that occasion. Okay, that's it. Any questions?
That last comment about collecting and otherwise, if they don't come back by 5, they stay out all day and night, then they'll become like karmis. Do you think that applies to all devotional service, book distribution.
Well, pujaris don't go out at 9.
Well, okay.
He's obviously talking about Sankirtan here.
Sankirtan, like Harinam, book distribution.
Yeah, yeah, you know, he's talking about the preaching.
So I have another statement. I remember this little comment that I remember reading, I believe it's in the Dallas Brahmacharya Ashram, where Prabhupada says all initiated devotees must rise before 4 a.m., attend the morning and evening programs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll start my response to your question with saying that I don't really know the Siddhanta, but I'll give you a couple things that you can think about, and you could discuss it further with more senior devotees afterwards. There's on one occasion there was a letter wrote to Gopijana Vallabha, disciple of Srila Prabhupada in New York. Prabhupada said to him, "Don't try to become a better Paramahamsa than your Guru Maharaj." He said, "I am attending the morning and evening classes, and you know, appreciating them. So you should do the same thing." That was a very famous letter. Archita remembers that letter like anything. So that's there. But at the same time, put the balance in there, Prabhupada was very pleased when he heard about, Ramaswar wrote him a letter describing how the devotees were, you know, doing the marathon, the Sankirtan marathon, and they were, you know, they were staying out very late. And then Prabhupada wrote a letter back to him. I can't remember the exact words, but something to the effect that this, you know, this, you're doing this book distribution without eating or sleeping. This is like samadhi. You know, so he was pleased that the devotees were making that extra effort to distribute his books. So that's there too. So what is the balance? What is the, I don't know. Archita, you can help.
I think you're being disingenuous. You do know. You've been doing this activity for years and you're still at it. So you do know the secret. And the secret Prabhupada gave in a line when he said, "Preaching means catching the fish without getting wet." So you have to know your ability. If you can't, if you're not trained, you know, like people go out and catch fish. If you're not trained to catch like marlin and stuff like that, you're going to get dragged in the water. So you have to know your ability. If you're going to stay out all day, so-called distributing books, and then you don't, you know, chant nicely, and then you fall down eventually, then you can't blame anybody but yourself. So you have to know your capacity. Those who are Maharatis that can do that and still remain strong in Krishna consciousness, that's fine. But you have to know your ability. So for most of us, it means you need a balance. You need to hear and chant, concentrate on that, do your service enough, but at the same time, save time for, you know, hearing and chanting nicely and coming before the deities. Like Prabhupada said, you have to do that.
John, so before we, anybody else have a question before I take Paramesh for a second? Mukunda Dattu.
Another essential principle here, it seems, is that one has to work very closely under the direction of the spiritual master for his pleasure. And if he's happy with whatever one is doing, then that's favorable for devotional service. And if he's displeased, then that's not favorable for devotional service. I'm thinking in particular of Mumbai in the old days. One day, Tamal Krishna Goswami came to Srila Prabhupada. All of the devotees in Mumbai at that time were very frustrated and working hard and just really stressed. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj came to Srila Prabhupada and said, "Srila Prabhupada, I haven't read your books in 6 months, but I've remembered the Mumbai municipal codes all the way back to 1936. So tell me what to do." And Prabhupada was pretty firm with him on this point. He didn't tell him to relax at all. He told him, "Sleep less." Of course, that was with Tamal Krishna Goswami. Not everybody has Tamal Krishna Goswami's capacity, but you know, the point is there that yasya prasadat bhagavat prasado.
Jai, thank you. Other question? Somebody other than Paramesh, for otherwise we'll take his second question. Okay, Param, you want to ask another question? Good.
Yeah, Prabhupada Nate at least wrote this letter that all initiated devotees must attend morning and evening programs, and then this, it also is explaining, hinting at the same thing. So does that mean if we just do our regular day of 6-8 hours of book distribution or whatever, and we come back 6-5:30, should we attend the evening program, or should we do our own thing, or what is the appropriate? What does Prabhupada want?
Well, can I take the Fifth Amendment? Can I take the Fifth Amendment? Fifth Amendment is that you don't have to say something that's going to incriminate yourself. Yeah, you should be attending the evening program. I don't, so that's why I'm asking, can I take the Fifth Amendment? But anybody else have any questions? Okay, so I've still got a few minutes. So I came across something very interesting on that same lecture that Prabhupada made that, you know, that exchange between Jayadwaita and Prabhupada. So I'd like to read it and take the advantage of that we have the association of Judhakarma, and perhaps you can make some comment upon this. I found this was on that same conversation. So this is a devotee named Radha Balaba said, Prabhupada, he said, Darwin actually admitted that there was a creator. He said, and then quoting Darwin, so we can see that the creator originally breathed the air of life into living objects, and from there on, evolution took place. And there was a pause, and then Prabhupada said, that is good. And then Yadavar, chimed in, he said, that theory is correct, isn't it? In a sense, that the bodies are always changing. So from the outward appearance, it seems that the evolutionary theory is correct. Srila Prabhupada said, no, that is accepting evolution, but their evolution is that there is no soul who is the proprietor of the body. That they do not know. Because in beginning is mistaken, your education, wrong platform, then whole thing is wrong. If study means that I am this dress, then do you study me properly? So that is their intelligence. They are studying, Darwin is studying this body, and no knowledge of the proprietor of the body. So I was hoping that Judhakarma could make a comment. What do you think? Any comment?
And whenever we deal with any topic, you know, you have to, get a fair appreciation of what Srila Prabhupada's position is on it, you have to look at everything he said on a topic. And actually, one of the projects I'm working on right at the moment is I'm compiling every single thing Srila Prabhupada ever said or wrote on the question of evolution, Darwinism, and things like that. And there are hundreds of statements that he made about these things. And when you go through all of them, you see he's very, clear on repeating, certain points that, the bodies aren't changing. It's the soul that's changing its position, going through different bodies, which is essentially what he's saying there. He said Darwin is just looking at the body, thinking how the body's changing. But the real point is there's a soul that's different from the body that's going through the different bodies. It's not that the, bodies are changing. It's the soul in different lifetimes moves through different bodies. And so that's, if you kind of look at everything he said, he's not saying that the Darwinian theory of evolution is true. He's just saying, well, Darwin may think like that because he's just looking at the material body and thinking how it may be changing. But the real point is there's a soul that's different than the body. And when you see things from that perspective, you can see that in different lifetimes, that same soul will enter into different bodies.
Thank you. That was exactly what I was hoping for. Thank you very much. Going to, we take it after another time. Amala Bhakti would like to say something. Not that I didn't want to take your comment, but I'm just...
What is it?
The time. I'm always looking. I'm like everybody else.
Real fast. Yeah. The point that was being made by Yadavar, that because the body is always changing, that would give some credence to the idea that also there's changes in the different species, that one species can change into another species, which is completely absurd. Because in the body itself has its own laws and its own program. And that program has been made by God, and it's also, it's changing, it's growing, it's becoming older and older, and then finally it dies. That's according to, just like you have a computer program, the body has its own little computer program, and that's been established by the Lord. But there is no program in the body which indicates, as a result of changes and changes and changes, then the body changes into another species. And this is basically what Darwin is saying, is that different species evolve. From one species, you come to another species. No, we go from childhood to boyhood or to girlhood to youth, and then middle age, old age, and then death, not another species. So why take that? Why take that analogy? It's not analogous to change. We don't change to another species. We just grow old, and then you again start over again, early age, up again. I see you now, and then I see your body becomes a monkey, or your body becomes... Of course, you do, but that's a different process. It's a spiritual process.
Let me go out if you don't mind. Sorry. Huh? No, but thank you. That's a good point. Okay, thank you very much. Guntaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.